I don't think you have to be AI to be a cybersecurity company today, but I think you have to be AI to raise money. And so that's why it's going to be one-to-one correlation if they're actually pitching. Now, if we were just kind of in the wild running across companies that are really providing value, I don't think they're all going to be AI forward.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Good to see you as always. Before we kick off, I always like to get a little update on what's going on. Sunil, you've got a gorgeous background now. You must be someplace really nice. I'd like to think this is your actual home now, but is it?
Well, if you consider a hotel room as my home for about half the year, then it is kind of my home. But I am actually staring out at the distance at Mont Blanc in Geneva, Switzerland. I'm here for an ITU conference called AI for Good, and I had a chance to present there. It's the standards organization for lots of things, but we're trying to figure out AI standards here. So, yep, that's where I am.
Well, it's fantastic. And, you know, I'm going to come back to you in a minute and ask about the new EU AI law at some point impromptu, because there's no way you avoided that while you were over there.
It's hard to avoid, but that's it. There's some views on that here too.
Mario, are you still freezing over there, or have things turned around at all in San Francisco?
It's still freezing, still miserable in San Francisco weather-wise, and but I'm going to Sonoma tomorrow, which is a wonderful 35 degrees warmer than usually my house in San Francisco. Yeah, so our Sonoma house tends to be a refuge from summer in San Francisco.
And so close. Yeah, the microclimates are amazing. You'd think you could just run a pipe between the two and start
totally
natural.
Totally. But, you know, Jerry's, I think what I want to know, with Sunil traveling half the time, half the year, traveling all these hotels, how does he keep so in shape? He looks great. Yeah. If I were to do that, I would be a pie boy by now, honestly.
Yeah, plus I'd be sick all the time at the airports
all the
and all this stuff. Like,
all
yeah,
the time. He looks great. You know, look at him. He never gets sick. He's smiling.
Well, one, take public transportation, walk everywhere, and just basically try not to overeat. It's really easy to overeat when you go travel.
And you don't, do you not drink, or do you not drink much?
I don't drink much. I don't really drink. I drink when
I think that helps
socially.
A lot.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's worth it, but I think that helps keep you healthy for sure.
It also gives you longer runway for your startup too.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, let's jump right into it. We got a little slate of topics as usual for today. One of the first ones, and you know, the way we do this is assemble some stuff throughout the week, some headlines throughout the usual fortnight between our episodes, and then jump on them. So. The first one, you know, a stock site, and I don't trust those much. They seem to be algorithmically generated news half the time, even before AI. But headline out here about cyber stocks and why now might be the time to buy. And what the article went on to say is there's a lot of cybersecurity activity right now. And then it's kind of immediately baked in that therefore there's a buying opportunity. And there were some allusions to the market not being being devalued a bit lately, and my reaction, I don't feel like cyber-related stocks have been depressed. I feel like they've been, you know, people have been pretty bullish on them for the last 5 years, and that the valuations and multiples are running pretty strong compared to tech stocks. Do you guys feel differently? Do you feel like there isn't more of an opportunity right now?
Well, so let's consider comparisons, right? So first, there's some general principles in investing, which is invest in what you know. Right. So since we're cybersecurity people, the question that we should ask ourselves is there a particular company or sector within cybersecurity that makes a lot of sense for us? Now, I would say in the context of the broader market trends, AI stocks are much better, doing much, much better than cybersecurity stocks. So then you have to figure out the confluence of the two, like which companies that are doing cybersecurity are also well positioned to jump on the AI craze or to help secure AI, for example. I think that's where we would see the potential uplift in a sector that we are familiar with.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one thing I will say is that cybersecurity, certainly AI now and more tech writ large, are all high PE ratio, in the case of cybersecurity, not profitable a lot, really in growth stage. Like nobody's buying the stock because they think it's going to stay the way it is. And so I'm not sure that that's changed. I don't think anything has gone down into where people are expecting dividends and that sort of thing. People are all betting on the future. And I think that's been true for a while. Valuations have been high, are staying high. It's tough to even find a PE ratio on some of these because they're inverted and the companies aren't even earning anything right now yet. So I don't see a massive buying opportunity. But as a cybersecurity person, I definitely invest in cyber. And I continue to look for individual opportunities. But I don't expect to come in now and exit when the company is profitable. I expect to come in now and exit when the hype gets ridiculous and it's just too much. It's time to go.
Yeah. There's also another general premise, which is everyone's a genius in a bull market.
Yeah, I like
which,
that.
Which leads me to what I think about this whole space right now. Okay, we're none of us here are financial experts, and we probably have our own teams that do this, and it gets really emotional if you're picking some of these on your own. So be careful with anything we say. You know, just take it with a grain of salt, right? That's my disclaimer here. So right now, personally, I'm thinking the global situations with tariffs and on and off. And Mr. Taco's approach to tariff management, it's really tricky right now to determine where the value of, you know, some of these cybersecurity companies, you know, they're going to follow trends, right? And how the global market is doing, you would think that may have an impact. So I think some of these stocks can be a little bit more, will get a little bit more beat up, in my opinion, which may not, so in other words, it may not be the right time to get in, but don't time the market either. Again, we're not financial experts. Second, you know, I really want to start paying attention. I'm personally paying attention to the public cyber companies in the how they're thinking about the AI space, not just internally for themselves, but as a competitive feature for their product. You know, if you would have asked me a year ago about what I thought about AI, I would have poo-pooed on the idea, right? I just walk away. That's all noise. Now that I've, you know, drank the Kool-Aid and I'm starting to wear, you know, my stripes as an AI believer in the church of AI, I'm starting to see things as, yeah, this is really changing things on how we work. So I would want to look for cyber companies that are either acquiring AI companies that match to what they're doing, or that's going to improve their current moat, or allow them to go into a space that they think is potentially advantageous for them.
What gives companies advantage, of course, is the concept of a moat. And so cybersecurity companies or companies that have a data moat will generally fare well in this AI ecosystem. I think there are companies that are well positioned in different segments of the cybersecurity market, so to speak, whether it's endpoint data, network data, traffic data, whatever it is, that put themselves in such a way that as AI grows or as AI usage grows, we'll see a corresponding growth in the value of that particular moat that they have as well.
I know we're talking about public companies, but on the private sector, we all see new companies being pitched to us all the time. Have you seen any cybersecurity company pitched to you today or in this recent whatever month that is not AI?
No, and I think that the reason is if they're talking to one of us, they're raising money. And so I'll say, like, I don't think you have to be AI to be a cybersecurity company today, but I think you have to be AI to raise money. And so that's why it's going to be one-to-one correlation if they're actually pitching. Now, if we were just kind of in the wild running across companies that are really providing value, I don't think they're all going to be AI forward. But, you know, to Sunil's point a moment ago, and I tell a lot of my non-cyber friends when they start asking about AI, I say that we, and so forgive me if I'm casting you know, with too wide a brush here, but that we divide everything into security for AI versus AI for security. And what I heard Sunil was saying was, you know, he's looking at the AI for security play, like the companies that are security plays, how are they leveraging AI? versus the companies that are securing existing AI. And I like that, and I agree with it. And you can't find a single, certainly by the time they're public companies, cybersecurity provider who's not leveraging AI or doesn't have some kind of AI feature. But to Sunil's point, as long as it's a optional thing, it's kind of ironic because on one hand, it has to be optional so people can opt in to using AI. But as long as it's optional and it's things like prompt, you know, windows where you could ask it a question, like let's just, I'm taking CrowdStrike, for example. I don't remember what I saw the last time I was in the console, but just using that, because most people know that it's an enterprise right detection and response software that pulls everything centrally. So if you could go in there and ask questions like, tell me all my endpoints that have seen malicious activity in the last 6 months, that's parlor trick crap. I'm not into that. That's just, you can disable it. If you're not comfortable, you can enable it and you can ask it questions. Everyone has put that into their product now, and I don't think people really want that. Where I think you're seeing value is when it says, oh, those alerts that you get, they were triaged with AI before they come to you. Like where it's not optional because it's baked into the actual performance of what's going on. Or while it's evaluating heuristics and evaluating processes and memory, if it's using AI at that point, and it's so elemental that you really, almost in the kernel, if you will, and it's so elemental that you certainly can't turn it off, because if that's successful, that should be a massive differentiator. When you're comparing three EDRs, if one of them has some superhuman advantage in actually discerning malicious activity from benign, that's going to be the value add. And you're not going to get that from just integrating Gemini or buying an AI company, right? You're going to get that with actual ML engineers and a specially trained set of models and onwards. So that's what I'm looking for to differentiate.
But when you're talking about ML engineers, it's more, would you agree that it's not like they're building new models necessarily, but rather they understand how to leverage existing models or how to leverage some of these existing commercial LLMs or commercial AI or even open source? Does that make sense?
It does. Sunil's going to have a more educated response on this, but I'll tell you from my perspective, my company, we went down this road, right? We didn't start talking about AI much or dreaming about AI. It wasn't like part of the equation here. And we ended up implementing AI. But it was really because it just gets the work done that the humans were going to be doing in the tool. So I'm really lucky. I can get ML engineers because I teach at Georgia Tech and it's 3 miles away, and everybody probably at any MIT, Georgia Tech, Stanford, CS has already been the biggest program for years now. It's really hard to get into the CS program. And within CS, in particular graduate school, the majority of the specialties, there's three or four specialties, and the majority of students are in the ML specialty and have been for, 10 years now? So if I want to hire someone out of Georgia Tech to do software engineering in any type, they're probably an ML engineer. That's probably their specialty anyway. So I stopped and asked three or four of them at some point and said, you're working on some AI stuff right now, but I think I know just enough about computer science to know it's kind of not a good use of your, it's not really leveraging your skills fully here, that really it's prompt engineering. Is that right? And if so, is that kind of emasculating? Like, do you feel embarrassed talking to your other ML engineer friends when they ask what you're really doing? You start describing, and do they say, oh, that's just prompt engineering? Like, he's writing prompts and firing that at OpenAI. And they put it to me with an analog like computer engineering, which is what I did study. And they were saying, like, not everybody at a computer engineering went on to work at Intel or NVIDIA and in the clean room, making chips. But, and this I totally can relate to, but people who studied computer engineering have an advantage when it actually comes to everything from deploying networks and wiring up infrastructure to also even coding, right? If you understand how microprocessors work and memory management, it does make, if you understand how assembly works, you don't have to be coding in assembly. So I think that's true. So to your question, no, I don't think everyone's doing hardcore ML engineering, but I'm really glad to have ML engineers doing the prompt engineering.
There is a discipline that is, or a job function that is really, really well suited for prompt engineering, and it's called library sciences. So Library sciences is the art of a librarian who has to be able to take an inbound question from a patron, a library patron, where they're asking for something about whales. And the library science person is supposed to be able to say, tell me a little bit more about what kind of whale you're, like, what's the purpose of why you're asking? What's the, give me more details for why you're asking this particular question. And the whole premise here is that through this whole process, you are actually just basically doing prompt engineering. And it's a, I bring this up because it is, it's a practice that's been around for a while, and it's not necessarily new. But it is a practice that we're having to now do because it forces us to think about the questions that we're asking. We're trying to figure out what are the right questions to ask. So I don't know if I necessarily say I need an engineer to do prompt engineering or ML engineering or somebody who is doing ML engineering, but rather library sciences is about how do you organize knowledge and how do you organize how do you ask the right questions to be able to get at it. So anyway, that's just a perspective that prompt engineering is actually not a new discipline when you look at it from the standpoint of library sciences.
But they're not, again, it's not when you're thinking about hiring, as we think about hiring some of these really smart folks, is they're not building new models. They just know how to interact with these systems, correct? Which is basically what Jerry, I think, Sunil and you are saying.
Yeah, so I think let's take it to the next level, though. I think prompt engineering, that's so 2024. Come on, Mario.
I'm still 2000.
As we all have heard, I'm sure, the 2025 is all about the agentic AI. And so it's no longer about just you prompting an LLM. It's really you arming an LLM with a whole bunch of other tools and enabling that. So it actually becomes, to some degree, an engineering effort. It's certainly much easier than what it used to be, especially with tools like protocols like MCP and all. But it is now wiring up other tools to your LLM to make it much more powerful. And it's no longer just about prompting the LLM. It's now about how do you design a system to do things that you would have otherwise had to do by hand.
Question, Mario, to your point, like, I do think that it's fair to say that, you know, in the advent of computer science and the race to suddenly build internet apps in, let's say, 1998 or something like that, I think the question is parallel to, are you building your own processor? Are you building your own architecture? And, you know, going back in time, I mean, back then that might not have sounded that crazy, you know, your Sun or Apple or ARM. But now that sounds ridiculous. Like, could have worked out for one in a billion, but why would most people even care about that? That's not the underlying.
What, Jerry? I'm shocked. You never wrote your own drivers? What are you talking about?
Drivers, maybe. And no, but but the actual hardware. Like, I think LLMs are, I'm going to use the word models are commoditized, becoming commoditized, and more importantly, they're becoming disintermediated. They're abstracted from the actual products. And one of the reasons for this is that, and this is probably a household phrase all the time, you can't keep up unless you're really plugged in, but it's probably bring your own LLM or bring your own model, right? Because when we are talking to enterprises, you know, we say, oh yeah, like out of the box, our prompts hit OpenAI on our account and all of that. But we have to be able to say yes when people say, oh, can you go against our model? Can you go against what we've gone through, all this TPRM and training, and we feel safe about this? Can you plug it in? And we have to be able to say yes to that. And I think that we're probably representative of a huge middle chunk of the AI apps that need to be able to bake everything into what they're sending to the models and not rely on owning it. And by the way, that also means that anything that's in our prompts we know will be disclosed, right? Because it's someone else's model, they're gonna be logging, they're gonna be prompt logging. And we were just talking about that today. And oh, well, that's our secret sauce, that's our IP. And take that assault on IP and combine that with the other problems with AI and intellectual property already, whether it's them learning from copywritten material or whether it's them generating material that now you can't assert intellectual property ownership over because it came out of a model, not yourself. And everything is getting turned upside down about intellectual property these days. But I think you have to let people use their own architecture, their own CPUs, and their own LLMs going forward for the majority of apps.
But bringing it back to this commercial, you know, public companies, private companies, you know, right now we're talking about the users and their interactions with AI, browser, et cetera, via browser or some other tooling. But as a AI company building a product ourselves, we and this is not unique to us. This is a strategy that a lot of companies are doing now. Is in, especially in agentic AI, there are zones. You're creating zones. So you're saying this agent can only do this. This agent cannot go across this boundary. This agent must never go and access that. And so we're starting to create this concept of zones. And Sunil and Jerry, please tell me if this resonates with you guys as well. And what I'm trying to figure out is, well, that feels like the next Wiz or Orca monitoring and looking for these agents and whether they're in the right zone or not, and whether they can, you know, violate whatever policy they're doing to get them, you know, to do things that they're not supposed to do. And Sunil, I think this is an area you probably are really aware of, my friend.
Yeah, what we believe fundamentally needs to also be defined is those zones that you're talking about and the policies around who can enter what zones and what are the actions that they're authorized to do within certain zones. Those are not necessarily well described within any organization. And so the concept of what you're talking about is precisely what needs to be established. The challenge is, within an enterprise, it's really hard to manage what those activities are, because really it reflects what we do in our day-to-day function, but it's not really prescribed anywhere. So how can we give a large language model these guardrails effectively, the guardrails that define these different zones inside of an organization? I've described it as a form of AI segmentation. It's similar to network segmentation, and network segmentation was really hard to do, right? But we nonetheless got it. We had to get it to work because of zero trust and trying to apply zero trust principles to a network. If you want to do zero trust for AI, then I think there's a form of AI segmentation that needs to also happen as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, I read an article recently, and we should put it up in the board here. I think it was worth it, but it was out of Andreessen Horowitz. Sorry, it was out of A16Z. And it was about pricing models in the age of AI, and what it specifically focused on was outcome-based pricing, which really caught my eye, because we were evaluating our own pricing models, but the idea is when you bring in AI, it's another insincere, inorganic pressure to do an agentic human-type model. Because it's easier to price. I mean, if you go to the average board director right now and you're trying to explain AI, and you're trying to sell a solution and they're not going to be the purchaser, but if you're trying to explain why you're going to charge that company for a solution that price-wise you want to be able to scale and you're using AI in it, and you don't want to say, oh, we're going to charge you $100,000 a year, and then 10 years from now go, oh, man, we should have charged them something variable. What should it have been? Should it have been by the action or by the seat? And then there's no seats anymore, right, because now everything is AI. If you say an AI agent can do up to 46,000 tasks per minute, and sorry, you're hitting 500,000 tasks per minute, so you're going to have to hire 10 agents. And by the way, they cost $48,000 each. It's comforting because you can explain that very quickly to a traditional buyer without having to explain some new unit, some new math, right? You could just say, look, this agent can do 10 times the work of one of your employees, and they're only $40,000 a year. And you need more. You need to add more agents. Why are things going slow? You need to add, and here's their names, and here's their serial number. Right? The totally. More that you mimic the model that they're used to, which is a human model, the easier it has become. That said, I don't, and that also makes access control and segregation of duties feel good, because like, well, this type of bot is only doing SOC triage, and this type of bot is doing proactive risk management, and this is your board deck preparation bot, and immediately they don't even ask about crossover, because, oh, good, the different bots. But when you go underneath the covers, engineering-wise, that doesn't make a ton of sense.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So is it impure?
Yeah. But just to add, bringing it back and trying to connect with what Sunil said and this whole network and zone and everything we had to do, and again, bringing it back to these public companies, again, I'm not suggesting you invest in these companies or anybody invest in these companies, but Palo Alto Networks and Zscalers are in this space today. Not indeed necessarily AI, but they're in that space of segmentation, network segmentation, traffic control, movement of information. I would want to know how they're thinking about this problem, Sunil and Jerry. Like, how are they thinking about this AI zone problem? Because either I'm sure they're going to jump on it. They're going to have to figure out, they're either going to build it or they're going to acquire a company. And so what I would want to know is, how is Palo Alto and Zscaler thinking about that, especially around these AI zones? And if not, do they have a blind spot that can then be exploited?
Yeah, so I don't think necessarily Palo Alto or Zscaler, or in general, the network providers, the network security providers, are well positioned for this. Instead, it's the data providers, or the people who broker access to data. And a classic example, or not a good example of this, and they were in recent news as well, is someone like Cloudflare. So Cloudflare, because of their function as a content delivery network provider, they are the ones that can say, we can be your broker, your access for creating segmentation for what data is available for training, right? And if you want to, there's a lot of negative externalities that are unaccounted for when it comes to the use of these AI systems. And we definitely see a lot of the content providers suffering with the negative externalities that they're not getting paid for the work that they're doing. And so the opportunity for companies like Cloudflare to be in the middle of that, because that's naturally where they sit already, I think it's a great position for them to be in, because again, as the AI ecosystem continues to grow, they can provide an interesting needed function within the ecosystem as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned Cloudflare. I don't know if this is what prompted that, but I saw a headline, I think over the last 48 hours, that now, for background knowledge for everybody, right, CDNs of some sort or another front probably the majority of material web traffic, of material websites. And I say material meaning the ones anybody cares about, right? There's a long tail of stupid sites. But the Alexa top X are fronted by at least CDNs. And Cloudflare, I don't know the market share, but they've got to be number one, two, or three out of that, right? Akamai, Cloudflare, and then the cloud providers themselves and their built-in CDNs. And that puts them in a unique position, first of all, for what you just said, Sunil. And then also, did you see the article about them throttling AI bots and agents that are scraping?
Right, exactly. That was the reference I was making.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's phenomenal. And it's not a matter of, I don't think it's a matter necessarily of access control. I mean, that's kind of nice. But it's more saying, if you want your AI bot to be able to, it's doing some computation and you want it to go out and fetch the latest market data from Reuters. Now Reuters, if they're behind Cloudflare, I mean, they could have done it on their own anyway, but Cloudflare is making an easy button for them to say, those bots are going to get back the middle finger or whatever the digital equivalent is of that, unless they've ponied up, right? And then I guess they get some kind of token or something, and Cloudflare sees that and says, okay, or charges them per. That's wild. I think that's the new frontier for sure. And it kind of goes back, it ties neatly with this outcome-based pricing. And now you have, if you think about it, you now have companies that have nothing at all to do with AI. They just happen to have some data, monetizing outcome-based AI pricing because the scrapers are the AI.
Yeah, and it's very similar to the picks and shovels of the gold rush. The picks and shovels are not necessarily for digging gold, but nonetheless, you have a bunch of miners buying those products. And I think it's in the same way, Cloudflare has positioned themselves in such a way that they're now part of the picks and shovels of the AI gold rush.
That's great. Full disclosure, I have Cloudflare stock. It's hard with a public company to know whether or not you need to disclose that since they're public, but Sunil brought them up first.
I don't hold any of their stock.
All right. Well, great. Good discussion. I appreciate that, guys. Moving on. So next topics. There's something about Microsoft moving AV providers, and it's funny to even use the term AV providers nowadays, but EDR or endpoint protection providers out of the kernel. Look, this is directly reflective of the dust up after the CrowdStrike issue. I'd say, right? And just saying that these providers had too much access into the operating system, and that enabled a mistake to be catastrophic. And in the immediate aftermath, I don't think there was a ton of panic about that, or it wasn't like table stakes that the OS providers had to move them out of the kernel, and Microsoft Windows in particular. But here they are, X months later, what is it, probably 14 months, something like that, and saying that they're going to give that a change here so that companies like CrowdStrike would not have direct kernel access and therefore in a mistake scenario could not cause the panic that ensued. Do you think this is a negative panic?
Can you guys remind me what's Microsoft's EDR? Is that Defender? I can't even remember what, right? So is Defender not going to have access to Microsoft's kernel?
Right. Well, if I remember right, and it was really during the initial everyone running one side of the boat, if I remember right, I thought it was antitrust that forced Microsoft to give them access to begin with.
Yeah, but you see, I think my point here is that if Defender, I mean, besides the fact that Defender is Microsoft, they can have access to the kernel behind the scenes, whatever. But so they'll know how the kernel behaves, so they don't even have to get access there. But if they wanted to do better protection, you'll need programmatic kernel access. I'm going to ask again, is Defender being removed from that? Because the reason I'm saying this, there's a lot of companies that, you know, I invested in a company here a while ago that was proud of themselves for the work they've done. I'm a believer in it, but my biggest fear was one day Microsoft is going to pull you out of the kernel and you're not going to be able to do what you've been doing for all these years. And they weren't too concerned back then. And they brought up this whole lawsuit and everything, but fast forward to today, look what's happening.
Well, okay, so this is complicated. it's complicated for a lot of reasons. But Microsoft in the past had a lot of hidden features or undocumented features to access the kernel. And back in the day when AV vendors and to some degree the EDR vendors, they worked to find these hidden undocumented features and use that to their advantage to have kernel level access and to discover things that isn't part of the natural, you know, the original suite, so to speak. What Microsoft would prefer everyone do is to use the APIs, the documented APIs, except that they just don't really do what EDR software, but it's not just EDR software. Like, for example, anti-cheating software operates at the kernel level as well. And so you have to, there are things that you need to do to be able to see if someone is manipulating things at user land. Okay. So it's not just for EDR. There's a lot of legitimate reasons why you want this kernel level access. The main point I think Microsoft's trying to say is, can you please use the authorized, like, blessed versions of these? And yes, I could still crash things horribly. There's things that can go horribly wrong, even with that level of through the APIs. Let's work out the right sort of balance so that we don't cause the kind of catastrophic damage that we had before, but you still have the access that you need to get whatever function you need to get done.
But you let the bad guys still continue to try to exploit the kernel and look for those backdoors that have been developed. But the good guys just behave goodly, properly.
Well, you could argue that that's a baseline that you establish, right? There's a set of activities that the good guys do, and really anything else beyond that should be flagged. Now, some of the things, of course, you know, you'll have anti-cheating mechanisms catch that, but then that's just that. This is really I would look at it as a call from Microsoft saying, "Hey, guys, we're all in this together. If you still want access, we need to have a better way to communicate what those weird anomalies are going to be ahead of time, so that we don't block your software, but your software also doesn't cripple 8.5 million computers around the world, or whatever. How many ever number computers there were."
On that exact note that you just said there, there was another headline here about some new AI malware proof of concept and reliably evading Microsoft Defender through iterative attempts. Is this do you see AI for the bad guys? We don't talk about that a ton. We talk about security for AI and AI for security. And whatever he wants us to talk about is AI for evil. Is that changing? Is that a concern yet? Is that starting to outpace? Does this article make you guys think that that you know bad guys are going to be leveraging AI better than us?
This is my shock face. I don't think it. I mean, this is like okay. You know, we've already had polymorphic. We've had tools in the past that would take any particular piece of software and make it essentially undetectable by pretty much all the AVs. So I'm not sure if this is totally new, but that said, I think we should have already taken the position that when it comes to AV, or at least the first line of defense, we should assume that that is going to get bypassed. And so this is the whole point of this is to say, hey, just make sure you have a secondary control or a control that in the attack chain, because we know that this first line of just signature-based whatever is not gonna hold up. I remember at Bank of America, we didn't really use AV to look for new malware, right? Because it just wouldn't. We used it as a way to. We found that AV or tools like Defender are extraordinarily efficient at being able to quarantine or remove what you've already discovered. Like, if you wanted to get rid of something across the entire ecosystem, this was a great way to do it because it was already built in and it was extraordinarily efficient at doing that. So whether it's getting a piece of malware or a browser extension or any other thing that you want to just purge out of the entire ecosystem, that's what it's really useful for today.
The big hit for me was the economics that bad guys are now able to leverage. Things are getting cheaper to do some of these things, much easier, much faster. So as Sunil said, the face, it's he's right. It's nothing new. It's to be expected, and I think it's going to get worse. It's only going to get worse.
All right, fair enough. So we like to talk about some of these headlines about major issues, and to me the bigger theme whenever I read these, we collect the hey, new vulnerability out, everybody patch now and that kind of thing, is that it's hard for people to understand and to just use the context clues or the kind of body language in these articles, because there's such a perverse incentive for people to publish things and get such a panic, and then you read their company name and how they're researchers, and hopefully it drives more business to them. So that's difficult now. Let's use that lens on this, this VS Code fork that supposedly could put every developer at risk, or millions of developers at risk. Did you guys see this thing and immediately jump on it and look into it? And if so, did you reach any conclusions, or is it just you're immune to all these things now because everything sounds like the end of the world?
Everything does sound like the end of the world. I mean, hey, we're in security. We should be paranoid, right? Let me unpack a couple things you mentioned. First is the greater prevalence of security companies tooting their horn about security findings. I put this in the same category as a lot of CISOs who are now working for security companies, in the sense that that it's almost like we should see that as an expected trend over time. We should see more and more of this, and that it's become the norm. I think partly because maybe because they pay better. I'm not sure about that, but in terms of there's a highly aligned incentive for more and more security researchers to work for security companies and not be part of a company that doesn't do security research or security as their core business. So I think the market alignment just happens to will cause that to happen more and more. And so I'm not sure if I would necessarily dismiss outright if I see a something from a security vendor tooting their own horn about some, whatever they discover, because a lot of times what they discover is legitimately bad. And I think I would actually argue that in this particular case, this is one of those. The issue being that the extension marketplace within VS Code, the open source VS Code marketplace, had various extensions that were basically compromised or could have been easily compromised. So that does create a lot of issues with developers because they have, you know, they're highly privileged and they have access to a lot of interesting things. So that was a real issue. I put that general finding into a bigger two bigger categories. One category I call PITA, P-I-T-A, plugins and third-party applications or extensions. PITA, of course, also stands for, you know, pain in the ass. I think it's a fitting construct to put into all those categories. It's all those things that extend these environments, extends the functionality of all these environments, but also creates these additional attack surfaces. But let me give you the second way to think about that. Consider all these different environments, whether it's your browser, it's your IDE, or it's your agentic AI system. Consider all those environments as a whole operating system of its own. And what we're really doing is we're running code inside these operating systems, whether it's an extension or a plugin, whatever else it is. And because we're running code, we now have a new operating system that we have to now defend against. Then this operating system, by the way, also has, I don't know if it only operates in user space or also operates in kernel space, but that whole conversation we just had about Windows, we're going to have to figure that out too for each of these new forms of operating systems. Because I think we need to have that distinction to say, here are things that, you know, need to be much more protected, and here are things that crazy stuff can happen in user land, and maybe we don't care so much because it doesn't have as much impact. But that whole construct, that model that we've seen in the Windows ecosystem, we probably need to think about what does that look like for IDEs, for browsers, for agentic AI.
That is a really deep topic. Maybe we should even dig another time that you're saying, Sunil, as you always do. I've been thinking about the same problem as well, and thinking about I didn't come out with this idea of these things like a new operating system. I forget who it was, Sunil and Jerry. Somebody did that presentation 2-3 weeks ago. I forget his name. Really prominent person in this space, and they're calling this the new operating system, and how we interact is like a new operating system. So my question is, are we going to experience the same thing we did with, think about Microsoft. Think about when Microsoft first came out, the year before 3.0, Microsoft 3.0. Yes, there was a Microsoft 3.0 at one time. And it didn't have network available. And then it started having networks afterwards, or ability to do networks. And then that exposed more things to us. And then we did a lot of file sharing, and that exposed new things to it. And then we wanted to do file sharing through, you know, like an IIS server, right? To do web serving. And then you introduce all these scripts. Are we bound to repeat the same mistakes we've made in this industry, but now doing it in AI and in a way that is accessing data, more data than we've ever had access to?
Absolutely. We're going to repeat the sins of the past, but hopefully we'll learn from them faster because we have templates, anti-patterns and good patterns that we can follow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been the hope for the last 5,000 years, right? That we would identify and use patterns from the past. I guess the quick answer to your question, Mario, is yeah, we are gonna fall into the same traps with maybe different labels on them, but welcome to humanity, I suppose. But you know, when I look at these headlines, and in particular, like shifting gears almost to the next headline here, right? Massive browser hijack, a bunch of extensions caused a bunch of issues. And then I looked through some of them and the names of these extensions to see, you know, what is it that people are installing. And they're things like be able to copy your emojis and send them somewhere else, or you'd be a color picker. And when I was growing up on computers, so to speak, I would, you know, hey, there's something I wish I could do. The operating system doesn't have it. I would quick search for it, I'd find some freeware, and I would download it, and I would install it with root privileges right away and run it. And that was kind of how I computed, right? So at any given point, probably 30 to 50% of the applications I was using were from untrusted third parties, no idea who wrote them. And it always kind of blew my mind that there was there were people out there that were willing to do that. And this goes back to our open source and whether it's going to be obviated by AI discussion, you know, that we recently had. And as someone who grew up like that, and I felt like I could smell out malware. Like, you know, if I downloaded something via, there was a window where you were downloading pirated software from LimeWire and installing it with a keygen that was cracking the licensing of it. And that didn't bring malware, but I think that was very short-lived. Like,
the good old days.
As far as I'm concerned, I would never touch that now. It might be because I have an American Express card, so I could actually buy software, as weird as that sounded when I was growing up. Or it might be that the trend I think I'm recognizing is legit, and that there is no altruistic writing of a cool way to pick your, you know, eyedropper for colors to get a palette off something. There is no altruistic emoji copy and paste. That everything has a catch, and if it's not ads and not marketing, then it's straight up malware and Trojans. So when I look at the list of stuff people have installed, of course they've gotten owned. I mean, what do you expect? Of course they have malware. Not a lot of sympathy there. You can't just go willy-nilly install browser extensions whenever they sound kind of neat at all. And in this particular case, if I remember right, the point was they were originally benign when they were written, and then later they were backdoored. So even if you were right in your spidey sense and saying this looks pretty safe, when you keep doing that auto update and they keep bringing it down, all of a sudden they're bringing down malicious code as well. So it almost sounds to me like my advice to family and friends is going to be never install a single browser extension, and maybe never even install anything that you download off of the internet. Is that crazy? And is it less crazy in Sunil's world, where instead they could just ask their agent to write a piece of code in an application that does X for them?
That's what I do. Believe it or not, I used to have a color picker. It wasn't that particular color picker, but I was like, hey, how hard is it for Cursor to write me an extension that basically does color picking? And guess what? It's actually really simple. So yes, but that's it. I would say though, at least for now, I don't know if it's unreasonable for us to believe that some of these that the normal user will just trust that these applications will work as advertised. I mean, similar to how we thought about it back in the day. You download something from Usenet after a long time after you've assembled it, right? Those who had that experience. Anyway, and then you run it because you're like, hey, it's a trusted community, right? You already expect it to be a trusted community. You expect Google or Chrome, the Chrome team, to have vetted it. You expect Apple and the App Store to have, to review it. And so I think there is a sort of, the whole system works because there's at least a minimal amount of trust that allows this to happen more seamlessly. If we had a completely, truly zero trust environment, things would be way more expensive. Things would run way slower. And so I think we as a society operate on at least some amount of baseline trust. But that's it. You know, you'll have attackers that will abuse them, right?
Let me try to bring it down to a practical. Tell me if this makes sense to all of you. At home, we have... Some of us have families, and some of these, you know, kids have access, maybe teenagers, preteens have access to either their own laptops or to a family share laptop, and hopefully, God not willing, access to your work laptop. And I feel, I guess the meta message for me is, don't let your children have access to your laptop if your laptop is what you're using to do banking or your personal financing on. And especially if it's your work laptop, because they're going to fall prey for this, in my opinion. Well, how does that work for you guys?
Yeah, so here's actually how I just do it on my own computer without anybody else accessing it. So I have different browser profiles, and each of those different browser profiles are for different purposes. My banking browser profile has zero extensions, has nothing. And I'm actually using the built-in password manager of the browser. I'm not even using an extra plugin just for passwords. I'm just using the browser as is. But there's no extensions, and there's nothing else I visit in that browser profile except those websites. So that's one way to think about it. It's like running, it's like a virtual machine, right? You're saying anything that's potentially dangerous or really sensitive, I'm going to run it within this isolated environment.
Dear Lord, Sunil, you're brilliant. You know, I tried to do this browser profiles and I was so pissed. I was like a honey badger in a cage. I was throwing stuff all over the wall, angry at myself. Why the heck did I set up these stupid profiles? And now you're like, I'm never going to do this stupid, silly thing. And now Sunil just educated me on the right way to use these profiles. Thank you, Sunil.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a cool topic. People will be interested in hearing about how we do the, how we do these setups. So first of all, I use a Chromebook for when I travel, and I have two of them, but they're basically the same. And the one at home, kids log into it, and you know, like you said, you're totally right, Mario, that it's a disaster out there because their dad. The best advice I give them is, "What? You installed what? Never use the computer." Right, it's always just a panic. Like, you know, don't have fun. Don't play Minecraft. Don't download malware. They're all the same to them. It's just crap that dad overreacts about. So I don't think I'm doing a great job of teaching them. Hopefully that'll get better as I actually can talk to them and they get old enough to talk computer science a little bit. So the Chromebook, I feel really good about that. Right, I log in with a different profile. It's completely fresh to me, including work. Right, I mean, I log into that with a work profile at times and I'm very comfortable with that. On a home computer, on the other hand, like we have this kitchen PC that the kids also, whenever there's any bandwidth possible, they are on it. Like, I mean, it could be 2 a.m. Our son was literally, we found out he was hanging out at 2 a.m. on the kitchen counter so he could look at this little Nest Hub because he figured out he could watch YouTube videos on a thing. So now even the Nest Hub goes offline at 8:45 p.m. The kitchen PC does everything. But if there's any window, they will find it, any device that can route IP. So this kitchen PC, though, they log into it. So there I use an enterprise browser. Right? I use Island only, which is a pain in the ass, you know, to use Sunil's term. By the way, Sunil, I was genuinely thinking that you didn't know what PITA stood for. And I was like, oh, Sunil, he's, bless his heart, he doesn't even know. But that it is a pain to use on the home computer, meaning I have to authenticate, right? And it's passkey, so I use a phone and I scan it and all that, and it's really cool. When the kids see that, they're actually impressed. So I like that they're actually learning about cryptography to a degree. And that's how I'm comfortable using a sandbox browser for, and it's relatively rare times I do work. But even my home profile, which you could also think of as banking, I authenticate to it, and I use a different browser profile for sure, but I also authenticate it every time. So I and that sucks because by default with Google, you have to kill your session. I have to log out whenever I'm done checking my email to make sure that session is still not active from that device. So that even if somebody logs in another session, if they install something malicious and someone gets onto the box, I want to totally blow away my session on there. And that's a pain as well. So I don't think it's, you know, super easy to manage. I do have multiple browser profiles on my in-office computer, which is where I'm on right now, and 99% of the time I'm there. And so I have my adversarial profile with Chrome, and I just checked because Sunil prompted me, and I have one extension on there, and it's a CRM app. And then I switch over to my personal, where ostensibly I do banking, and that has one extension, which is Zoom, which now I'm done with that. We don't really use it very much anymore. And then I have a third profile for Georgia Tech where I do, you know, academic stuff, and I don't authenticate to that, you know, on my own device because I think anything I'm going to do with academia, it's going to be completely tainted. It's just too hard to secure those environments. So I use a separate browser profiles as well. But when it comes to extensions, I don't think it's the profile switching that's saving me as much as the fact that I have almost zero extensions. And I don't use a password manager. My team here is adopting 1Password, and I'm doing it reluctantly. I thought the browser, the Chrome in particular, password manager was great. And you know, part of it is because I wasn't installing extensions, and it was native, and I had separate profiles, which means a different password store for my work Chrome profile versus my personal and onward. But I'm just, you know, and maybe it's because I don't have fun anymore. Maybe it's because I'm not listening to composing music and doing fun stuff and playing games anymore. But I'm just a total prude when it comes to extensions or doing anything fun on computers these days. All right, so next topic here. U.S. government takes down some North Korean remote IT worker operation. We've talked about that a few times, and about how, it seems like an epidemic in our circles and CISO circles. I think people are talking about it all the time. How do I know that this person that I'm talking to isn't really a North Korean operative, so to speak, or whatever it may be? I said it seems like an epidemic. I think it's just because it hurts so much, right? When somebody finds out that happened to them, it only takes one, even in a 100,000 person organization, if they find out one person was actually a North Korean operative in there, it's getting all the press and all of that. When you look at the raw numbers of the damages done, they're completely immaterial. They're kind of minuscule. There's a Department of Justice indictment, and it mentioned $900,000 across a whole crime ring, and that's like not really that much. So I guess the things that come up are, A, how rampant or how damaging was this? How big of a deal is this? And then B, is this takedown operation symbolic? If so, is that helpful? Is it actually going to make a dent in these things? And is there something else that companies should be doing to prevent this from hitting them?
Okay, so let me frame this this story as well. Yes, it's definitely seemingly worse when it's tied to a North Korean, because you have to assume the worst from that standpoint. But from a procedural standpoint, is it much more different than somebody who's moonlighting? So you may have also seen, there's another story that was going around the circles of this one guy from India who was working for like 6 or 7 Y Combinator startups. Okay. And the question that was going around is that really okay? Okay. Now, from a security standpoint, we'd say, wait a second, no, we would not want that, because you have total, possible transfer of information, blah, 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 whatever. Okay. But don't we already guard for that through, wouldn't we already want to be guarding for that through DLP, whatever, right? Because if we're that concerned, then we'd have controls to avoid that contamination across different machines and whatnot. So you'd argue you'd want to do the same with the North Koreans too, or whoever it might be. Whether it's North Koreans or somebody who's moonlighting, you'd have the same sort of perspective.
Yeah, I was talking with my wife about this, and about this exact headline, and it's interesting. She hasn't worked in like a white collar office environment, but I already kind of knew what her reaction might be, and she confirmed it. And it's like, to your point, if somebody's working for 6 different companies, and the problem wasn't that he was only 1/6 productive. Right. The problem wasn't that he only did 1/6 as many commits as they expected, and put out 1/6 as much code. And the problem was that they found out that he was working for 5 other companies. They were otherwise perfectly happy with his output. And that just means that, and empirically, we know he was only 1/6 productive. Like we just know that. And so that means that companies generally don't have very good visibility into what kind of productivity employees are putting out. And I think that's accurate. And I think that the bigger the company, the worse it is. And that's probably the real headline here. Isn't that somebody is working somewhere else, but it's more that someone could only be working 1/6 and that's just fine. And sorry, I think a lot of it has to do with remote. I think, especially nowadays, if somebody's never worked in an office and they come out of school right now and they work remote and they phone it in a bit and they're not used to, they're not cheating. They're not like trying to get around controls and not trying to underproduce. They've just always walked the dog 7 times during their workday. They've always taken 2-hour breaks.
Yeah.
They've always gone somewhere for 90 minutes every single day of their career. So they're not hiding it or anything. That's just the bar for productivity these days. Then I'm not surprised it's hard to tell when someone's working really hard for 6 companies.
I'm going to take a different angle on this stuff, because I don't understand how I have time to think about these problems. But here you go, because this is really, but if you think of North Korea being this, if you think the Chinese firewall and all those controls they have in China is tough, imagine the North Korean Uber firewall, right? There's just no way you're going to access the world outside of North Korea. Well, is it in their best interest of society and the world to have these North Korean folks working and accessing stuff? I mean, they're doing coding, but they're also accessing the public internet in the Western world. And so if I'm the United States government or a European government, why not begin to infect their minds by showing them what the real world outside of North Korea looks like? And you know these folks, I know even if they work for the government, they're going to start talking. That's what human beings do. And next thing you know, they're going to say, my goodness, those guys in the West, everything we've been told is wrong. It's actually a paradise out there. You know, they don't have any riots in the West. They don't have any police state in the West. What are you talking about? Anyway, my point is, it actually might end up being a good thing that we're infecting some of these folks' minds by exposing them to our Western world. What do you guys think?
That's fine. You know, that brings me back. I remember September 11th, right, 2001. And in the following, you know, 18 months and onward, right, we were all just chatting with our friends all the time about, like, how has this happened? How have we gotten into this situation here? And how do we solve the problem of people on the other side of the world absolutely hating us, and everyone just woke up and realized, oh, there's these groups that have been trying to kill all of us, and they just weren't good at getting on airplanes with box cutters before, and now they figured that out, but they've always wanted to kill us, and what are we going to do about that? And I remember one of my friends would always talk about, you know, McDonald's and Taco Bell being the salvation of the world, and that, you know, you put those together with, like, HVAC, right, air conditioning, and you bring them to places, and suddenly they don't want to kill you as much, right? Just a little Taco Bell, a little McDonald's, and a little bit of air conditioning, and on and on. Whether or not that's true, I'm not sure, because of the ideology behind all of it. And the fact is that here we are, and there's a lot more Taco Bell and McDonald's, and still a lot of people wanting to kill you and I. But, I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about a little bit, of, like, taking people out of there. And, it's similar to the I got a call yesterday, an auto call while I was on vacation, and it started out with a woman saying, this is Walmart, this is not an advertisement, this is the Walmart website, your Walmart account has been used to purchase a thing and it costs $949, and I ran out of time and hung up. But I, you know, it was call tree, press one, and then there would be a long delay and I'd be connected to somewhere like 2,000 milliseconds away, and finally they'd pick up and me across the world and try to ultimately scam me out of a little bit of money. And I hung up on it. And then a human called me the next day and started with the same ruse. And right, I started talking to him. Like, how do you feel about being a criminal? You know, and that was kind of you. You've got this worker here in North Korea. And hey, well, how do you feel about this internet? Isn't this great? I mean, you know, we can buy things. Have you heard all the coworkers talking about Amazon? Like, you could have done that if you weren't there. You should overthrow your regime and all that. But man, it just doesn't really work. It didn't work on the dude that called me, and he's got a bunch of other criminal calls to do. And I guess, and this article that we're talking about in North Korea, I browsed through it quick, the lead image. But while my main brain was moving on to read the actual text, one of my brain co-processors was still chewing on the image it saw for just a brief second. And it was these guys in North Korean uniforms in a cubicle farm, as I remember. So I'm sure that must have been, I didn't go back and study it, but it must have been an AI generated. But if you use that image, I guess those guys, you know, when you're sitting there saying, come on, Amazon, Slack, video games, come on. I imagine someone's behind them saying, get back to work. You need to be hacking that next company, and that you just don't get through.
Yeah. So, okay. So first, they're usually not based in North Korea. They're usually in China, Thailand, some other part of the world. So they're usually not in North Korea itself. Two, that picture of those North Koreans. There was a funny picture of, I think it was the Chinese military and their cyber army. And it was this very, you know, it was this massive group of people all on their computers. And if you zoomed into their screen really closely and looked at it properly, I mean, looked at the right aspect, you realize they're playing StarCraft. So anyway, it's the classic Chinese military cyber army. You'll find it. I'll send a link to it. Anyway, as far as passing on Western values, South Korea already does this to a great degree of success, which is all these North Koreans know about South Korea, K-pop, all the movies and the lifestyle. They actually all know that. So it's not like they are unawares that their southern neighbors are actually much better off than they are. While they're starving or just undernourished and whatever, they see all this wealth down there. So you have to wonder then, what's the other reason why that's happening, right? Why they're, and to some degree, it's because they're compelled to, right? They know that if they don't do this, then their family back home is going to get a bullet to their head, which isn't very pleasant, right? That's also why you have these soldiers, North Korean soldiers in Ukraine, basically being cannon fodder, because they know that if they don't do that, their family and home is going to get, you know, get killed as well. So it's pretty rough for them. I don't think it's because they don't know the lifestyle of the Western economies and such. I think it's just because there's other pressures. And
I don't know, Sunil. If I had to be forced to listen to K-pop, I'd go back to North Korea, man. I'm sorry.
Oh, man. Well, hey, by the way, on that note, do you guys both follow the balloon wars? So a part of the propaganda, it's a propaganda campaign in a literal sense from South Korea. They don't just know about K-pop because of the FM radio getting across it. They actually drop media into North Korea, and they send up balloons that drop flyers. And I don't know if it just says, hey, life is even better down here. It'd be great if you overthrew your leader, whatever it says. I'm really sure. So North Korea doesn't like that, which is, you know, kind of a sign that maybe it has some efficacy. Otherwise, why would they care? So they don't like that. So what they started doing in return was sending their trash with balloons. They just started sending these trash balloons all the way down, just dumping all the trash out.
99 ref balloons. I am hearing that German song in my head already.
Trash balloons, 99 trash. Yeah, I don't remember the German word for trash. All right, our last topic here. So security awareness training. I feel pretty strongly about this. But in particular, there was an article here saying that it can be counterproductive. Before I soapbox about it, when do you want to summarize what this thing was saying and add any color to it?
Basically, it said that phishing training made employees more susceptible to future phishing training. So you're training people to feel overconfident about what they've learned to be able to detect a phishing attack. And so that made them even more vulnerable. So in essence, we are training for phishing, but we're training them to be Uber phishing traps. As in, you're going to fall for that trap.
So I think my perspective on this has been consistent actually for a while, which is that phishing training does work if the training is properly calibrated. And I'll give you a simple example that we all can understand from the standpoint of school. If I give a fifth grader a 12th grader calculus test, okay, they'll get pissed off. They'll be like, why did you give me this phishing email that suggests that click on here, if you don't click on it, you won't get considered for bonuses during bonus season, okay? Because that is like a 12th grader test for a fifth grader. If I give a 12th grader a fifth grader test, they'll be like, come on, no problem, done, thank you very much. I know my phishing because I can pass this fifth grader test, you know, thank you very much, right? So there's that overconfidence aspect of things. But what if you actually gave a fifth grader a fifth grader test and a 12th grader a 12th grader test? Actually, not a 12th grader a 12th grader test. What if you gave them a college level test, like a freshman college level test, which basically pushes them to learn more and say, ooh, I missed that one. I should have done better, okay? If you give a fifth grader a sixth grader test, they would, I think, feel the same way. If you gave a fifth grader a 12th grader test, again, they would be pissed off at you and say, phishing sucks. Phishing simulation sucks. Why are you doing this to us? But I think if you give them something that they can achieve some mastery or feel like they're gaining a mastery on, then I think that's the proper way to do training. Because the phishing training is the only place where I think we miscalibrate the type of training to the type of people who need to take the training.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. Not opposed to my thoughts on it, but maybe complimentary. For phish testing in particular, and I've done a lot of security awareness training. Right? I've done advisory work for companies where they either ask or I encourage them to force me to take their security awareness training. I always think that everybody should do that after administering it and trying to get to 100% completion rate in large organizations for years and going person by person at the end there. I really don't want to dog food it. So I've taken a lot of this stuff. And I find, for one, phish training, spotting the phish, encompasses the lion's share of security awareness training at most organizations. And I think that alone is a major issue. And then within the phish training, there's still this myopic focus on the email composition, which never made any sense. Like if your training says look for misspellings, that's stupid. And you know, I have 5 young children, so I don't use that word very freely. Very careful about the stupid word. But I use it when it really matters, and it matters there. It's really accurate. People can use spell check that are malicious. Or, oh, God, I know the worst was, I hope this guy doesn't remember the specific anecdote as he's listening to the podcast. Hopefully it stood out more to me, and he doesn't even know I'm talking about him. But I was at an event, and I met another CISO for the first time. And while the presentation was going on, he leaned over to me with his phone and said, look at this phish test my red team just made. It's so awesome. We're going to fool all the employees with it. And that alone was kind of like, huh? You know, like we all knew how to fool the employees. Phish tests were never supposed to be, that sophisticated. And he said, just look at it. And it was from Amazon. And then he zoomed in. He said, look at the Amazon logo. It's not really an M like Mary. It's an N like Nancy. It's Anazon. It's spelled wrong. We showed him. What the hell is that about? You think that fishers have to obey copyright law? I mean, and that's literally what we're teaching people, is to look for changes in the logo. Why would the logo be different? It doesn't make any sense. Or bad English. Anything that you can come up with is easily overcome if you're actually the bad person. So,
and for the record, that wasn't me. The audience, that wasn't me that he's referring to, right?
Success. I was hoping you wouldn't remember. But anyway, but what should we be teaching people? It's not spelling. It's not context. It's pretty simple. It's asking you to do something that would give a third party an advantage. Right? Hey, will you send that money? Those are all suspicious, including when the CFO asks you. And there may be some legitimate reasons for the CFO to ping someone and say, it's an emergency, I need a wire done now. That's going to take a while. That's going to be, hey, I'm not sure. And if you're the type of leader at a company, a type of CFO that says, don't you know who you're talking to? I asked for a wire transfer now, and I'm the CFO, damn it, and it better get done now, then you deserve to get phished, and your whole organization does. And your whole board should know that that prima donna in the CFO chair is adding more cyber risk to the company than any phish testing can ever ameliorate, right? Because the correct defense is to be suspicious when there's an action. Will you take this data? Will you give me this password? Will you reset this credential? Will you make this wire transfer? And as the requesters of those types of actions, culturally, executives have to say, hey, I need you to do this urgent thing. I would never expect you to do this right away. That would be really irresponsible of you. I expect you to run the traps. I expect you to call half the people at the company to make sure this is real and ask for a video and everything else. I'll wait, as urgent as it seems to me. So the training, it can't be just about phishing, by the way, right? Because the same thing can come in via a phone call or by somebody on the street. It Yep. needs to be, don't just how high when an executive asks you to jump and immediately capitulate to try to impress them with how fast you act. Impress them with your diligence and how you're following up on anything that could actually endanger the company. And so I think security awareness training should be here to stay, has a lot of potential. Actual phishing should probably be 5% of it. And it really should be focused on general culture and also things like the non-obvious things, like is it okay to print at home? Right, you're not getting that in package no before training because it's a different answer for every company, but that's where the magic happens, right? or is it okay to let my kid log into a profile on my computer? And you think you know the answer. It's different for every company. Is it okay to log into my personal Gmail while at work? There's no right answer for that either. But each company has a different answer. And when you deliver that info, that's what security awareness training should be.
No, and I think, Jerry, you're internally focusing your internal focus, internal locus of control is right on the, you know, executives demanding. If that's your attitude, you are creating that environment for employees to fall prey to some of these things. But I'm going to go external focus. I don't like to do that, but I do want to ask you, I do like to see the industry do two things. One, cyber insurance companies, please make this less important when you're doing your assessment on an annual basis. Really, Jerry said a really important thing. We're not talking security training, folks. He's right. Security training is one thing. It's this security training that's overwhelmed by these phishing training simulations and attacks. They're really not as useful. And Jerry's completely correct about that. But we need to lean in on cyber insurance industry to stop forcing that. And second, all those like FedRAMP or any of those certifications that require that the auditor perform a phishing training simulation or phishing attack on the employees as part of your certification. We had to go through that with FedRAMP. It is the silliest thing ever. Stop doing it. It's not effective. It is not a representation of how effective somebody's security program is.
Yeah, I think that's... Look, BitSight was the chief offender for this first. It was just when all you can measure is one thing, then that becomes the placeholder for everything. And I think insurance has the most incentive to get it right. So they've been way ahead of the security ratings companies and I think pivoting towards more meaningful things and controls. And I bet you that they'll move off of that a lot more quickly than just the generic ratings and security ratings firms will. All right, guys. Well, it's been fun as usual. We talked about the latest versions of all the latest topics, whether it's CISOing to AI and everything else in between, and a little sprinkle of North Korea, which seems to be a recurring theme. But thanks a lot, guys. I'm looking forward to the next episode already, and we'll speak soon.